From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, intention, those kinds of experiments, does it work? Here's what's happening, though. NOAA forecasters have raised the odds of an X-class solar flare to 30%. Oh, boy, here we go. Two sunspots turning toward the planet pose a threat for such eruptions. They're called AR-2157, AR-2158. They are big. Both are capable of very strong geo-effective activity, as they say. As we reported yesterday, a mysterious late-night blast in the Nicaraguan capital of Managua that left a crater 40 feet wide was most likely caused by a meteorite now, according to government scientists. Boy, if it was any bigger, it could have been a disaster there. As you know, we've talked about the Yellowstone volcano. We're going to be doing that on our program tomorrow, by the way, in a big way. But the United States Geological Survey, the USGS, has provided its monthly update on the Yellowstone volcano. That's the caldera. And 207 earthquakes were registered in the area, which is quite an increase from July when there was only 99 earthquakes. So August showed a lot of activity there. They do say that that caldera erupts every 600,000 years. It is overdue. And if it does go, they say that could bury the United States in ash. Bury the entire planet, the entire region of the United States. A respiratory virus is sending hundreds of children to hospitals in Missouri, possibly throughout the Midwest and beyond. The unusually high number of hospitalizations reported now could be just the tip of the iceberg, according to the CDC. 10 states have contacted the CDC for assistance in investigating clusters of what they call the enterovirus. Colorado, North Carolina, Georgia, Ohio, Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Kentucky. The expert, by the way, on infectious diseases, Gary Ridenour, with us. Gary, have we heard much about this? Is it common or is this brand new?
No, enterovirus 68 or EV68, which is, I kind of like to call it EV68, was found in 1962. There have been some rare outbreaks since then, but suddenly Evie's got some legs on her, and there's no community resistance, so it is just ripping through the states right now.
How serious is it?
It's interesting. We don't see much of it. It's the most common enterovirus infection with acute respiratory infections in China, and we send it over there for some reason. But at this point, there are no reported deaths, hundreds of children going into hospitals with asthma-like symptoms and severe cold-like symptoms.
Real sick. 475 children recently treated at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City. Here in St. Louis, my little four-year-old grandson, Simon, he's been sicker than a dog, coughing and wheezing, too, so he might have that. They brought him to the doctor today. Gary, thanks. We'll continue watching this situation. Gary Ridenour, his website, pandemicdirect.com, by the way. Vaccinated monkeys have developed long-term immunity to the Ebola virus, raising a prospect of successful human trials, according to scientists. The experiments by the U.S. National Institutes of Health showed immunity could last at least 10 months. What about after that? Well, they haven't said. In London, Jack the Ripper, one of the most notorious serial killers in history, has been apparently identified through DNA traces found on a shawl, according to a claim in a book. The true identity of Jack the Ripper, whose murders terrorized the murky slums of Whitechapel in East London back in 1888, has been a mystery ever since, with dozens of suspects that include royalty, prime ministers, down to bootmakers. But after extracting DNA from a shawl recovered from the scene of one of the killings, which matched relatives of both the victim and one of the suspects, Jack the Ripper sleuth Russell Edwards, in his book, claims the identity of the murderer is now beyond doubt. He says the infamous killer is Aaron Kosminski, who worked there as a bartender. And there have been emotional scenes at a temple in Beijing, China, where relatives of passengers on board the Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 gathered to mark now 6 months since that plane disappeared. About 30 relatives listen to a man read a poem, some crying, sitting on the floor. Jim Sanders, he's been with us since March 8th on this episode. Still nothing, Jim. I can't believe it. Still nothing.
Well, you know, if that airliner had disappeared today or any time in the last couple, 3 months, everybody would strongly suspect, since it was headed towards Somalia or Yemen, everybody would strongly suspect that, in spite of the misdirection campaign, would strongly suspect that that's where it went. Now we have a report out that almost a dozen airliners have disappeared in North Africa over the last few weeks. I haven't seen it in any major media. I don't know if it's a true story or not. But I think it's fair to say that the explosion in violence that actually had started back in March, but really didn't spool up here in the United States and in the dominant media, it was going. There's no doubt in my mind that an attempt was made to use that as a flying bomb. I doubt that that airplane is still available for use.
And you've heard the story of ISIS people taking commercial airlines from the Libya Tripoli airport.
Right, right,
exactly.
What are
they going to do with that? Yeah.
Right, so, you know, you have 9/11 coming up, and they always like to do something big on one of the days, and I thought for sure they'd try to go for bin Laden's the day he left this earth, but... you know, 9/11's around the corner. So if, in fact, all those airliners did disappear, I'd say 9/11's going to be a pretty spectacular day.
Jim, I should ask you, too, what have you been working on these days?
Oh, my goodness. I have to be guarded in what I'm saying, but I have found extraordinary documents for two projects I'm on, one having to do with Flight 800, the documents that I didn't think we'd ever be able to locate, but we now know where they are, and we're trying to get some lawyers lined up to get them for us through the Freedom of Information Act. But we know right down to the file number exactly where this stuff is.
All right, when you're ready to release it, you know where you're going, right?
Okay, yep.
Right here on the show. Jim, thank you so much. Jim Sanders, his book, The Downing of TWA Flight 800 as well. Well, we're going to talk in a moment about narcissistic people. Why do they do what they do? And what does it all mean? Up next, our special guest, W. Keith Campbell, joins us. PhD, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Now, this is a topic for the next couple hours we have never discussed on Coast to Coast. Narcissism. Now, it's the pursuit of gratification, admiration of one's own attributes that derive from arrogant pride. The term originated from Greek mythology, where the young person named Narcissus fell in love with his own image reflected in a pool of water. But what does that mean with people? How does that affect them? How does that affect us? W. Keith Campbell, PhD, nationally recognized expert on narcissism and generational change. His work and lectures expose the rise of narcissism and individuality, more generalities, and its influence on the level of society. He's talking about an epidemic here. His book, The Narcissism Epidemic, Living in the Age of Entitlement. And Keith, welcome to the program. This is a first for us.
Well, it's a first for me, too. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. Well, first of all, you gotta tell me, how did you even get involved in studying this topic?
Yeah, you know, it was something that when I was doing my, you know, my PhD work, I found it really interesting as a way to see how people work with, you know, most of us create stories in our lives, but people who are narcissistic do it in sort of this big and sometimes, you know, comical way, and you really can see it operate. And I just started pursuing it, and then like the people now who study Ebola and lo and behold, there's an epidemic. The world sort of got more and more narcissistic and didn't enough work for 20 years.
Give us your definition, Keith, of narcissism, if you would.
Yeah, I mean, the simplest definition is just a grandiose or inflated sense of self. You think you're a legend in your own mind. You think you're better than other people and better than you really are. And what makes narcissism interesting is you have these very positive beliefs about yourself, and then you have to arrange your life so you can constantly look good. So you see people name drop or get a trophy spouse or drive a fancy car, They jump at opportunities to take credit for success. When things go wrong in their life, they blame other people. And so they set up this whole world, you know, that makes them look like the center of attention and admiration. And if, when it works, they're happy. And when it doesn't, they get very angry.
There is a difference between narcissism as a personality trait and as a disorder, right? Is it a disease?
Yeah.
Okay, what's the difference?
Yeah, that's a great point, because people mix this up a lot. We can talk about narcissism as a trait, where, and by a trait, I mean some people have a lot of it, some people have less. Most of us are in the middle. We're a little bit narcissistic. When it gets really extreme and it starts messing up your life, it can be diagnosed as a disorder. Often what happens with people is it's one hand, you go to work and people say, hey, great job, and you feel good about yourself. But if you go home and your kids, you're like, hey, want to hear about dad at work? Hey, check dad out. You do the same thing to your spouse. You do the same thing to your friends. It starts to damage your relationships. It can be diagnosed as a condition.
Is it easy to pinpoint someone who's narcissistic?
You know, there's certain signs. I mean, there are things you can see, especially over time. So you can see people who maybe draw attention to themselves in conversation. So you start talking to somebody about a problem you have, and next thing you know, you're talking about his problem. I heard a story once of a woman who told a friend she had cancer, and pretty soon they were talking about her friend's bad day at work. There are people who draw attention to themselves, talk about their good attributes, very materialistic, those kind of things. So you can see it over time. The challenge is when you first meet people, it's often hard to pick up. People who are narcissistic can be very likable, very charming, very outgoing. It's why they end up, you know, being elected to office and hired and things like that. Yeah.
Keith, do they hurt people physically?
You know, when you find it, you do find a narcissism leading to aggression in certain situations. When you have somebody who's very full of himself or herself, and then you say, you give them some sort of negative feedback, you're a failure, you're a loser, or they feel rejected, they can become aggressive. So, I mean, an old case, but something like the O.J. Simpson case, where you have somebody who had a spouse and the spouse took off and he felt rejected and allegedly murdered her because of that. That's the kind of violence you see with narcissism.
Is there a difference between someone who is narcissistic and someone who's a psychopath?
Mm-hmm. Well, when we look at these personality traits, we find there's a group of them that go together. They're almost like the same species or cousins in a way. And one of those is narcissism, another is psychopathy, and there's some others I can talk about as well. Psychopathy and narcissism share a relatively callous view of others. You're willing to hurt people, take advantage if you can. What you find that makes them different is people who are psychopathic are often very impulsive. They can't control their behavior very well, so they get in trouble a lot. That's not something you see with narcissists. And they have the grandiosity, but they also tend to have, you know, at least average levels of self-control. So psychopaths end up more in prison. Narcissists end up more in the boardroom.
I was going to say, are the narcissists very successful? And I take it they are.
Yeah, they definitely can be. I mean, part of it is that, you know, narcissism is, it can make you confident, and people, you know, you like confident people. You want to support confident people. And if they have that self-control, so they're not going out there and doing flagrantly stupid things like you see with the more, you know, higher levels of psychopathy, they can do very well in life.
I went through a list of traits of narcissistic people, Keith, and let's go through each one. One says, an obvious self-focus in interpersonal exchanges. So now what does that mean?
Well, that's sort of the example I gave you before. You know, we're talking and we're having a conversation, and pretty soon it turns, you know, I start talking about how great I am or something about myself rather than what we're talking about. So you turn your personal interactions, your conversations back towards yourself.
Okay. Arrogance. That's obvious, I guess.
Confident. I mean, arrogance, haughty, cocky, cocksure, you know, kind of an arrogant jerk. Yeah.
Envy.
That's an interesting one because clinically people have talked about people who are narcissistic as being envious of others, meaning, gee, that person seems so successful. I really want that. It's a little bit debatable. Sometimes people who are narcissistic show that, sometimes they don't. But that's where that trait comes from.
They say about shamelessness. Now, how would that be narcissistic?
You know, that's not a term I would use, but when you see it and it's used in terms of promotion, it would be. So you see somebody on Twitter saying, you know, check me out or whatever with a picture of themselves with no shirt on. You go, man, that's shameless.
Okay, you know, braggy. They say braggy.
I think in that case where it's like, hey, look, I'm willing to just go out there and put it out there. You'd say that's shameless, but that in that sense, I think it would be narcissistic.
So you put all these traits together, and can men and women, who generally is the narcissist, a man as opposed to a woman?
You know, most of the time you see men are more narcissistic than women. It's in the personality trait, men are a little more when it comes to a psychiatric diagnosis. Men get it a lot more than women. The only exception I've seen to this is a study done on reality television stars that just happened to find that the women were much more narcissistic. But most of the time, men are, by a small amount.
Are they developed or are they born?
A little bit of both. Like a lot of personality, there's some evidence that, you know, people who are narcissistic have narcissistic children, partly because of the genetics. But also there seems to be some role parenting plays. And there's two basic factors. First of all, parents who are cold or abusive, that sort of general parenting can lead to all sorts of problems. I mean, narcissism, but it's not very specific. What you see that's more specific to narcissism are parents who put their kids on a pedestal, think their kids are uniquely gifted or special, dote on their children. It's almost the spoiled child model.
Keith, you talk about what you call the dark triad, which is narcissism, being a Machiavellian, a sadist. Tell me about the mix with these.
Yeah, that's what when you talk about these traits, there's this family that go together, and what they all share is, yeah, I'm willing to take advantage of people. And narcissism is where you're focused more on getting attention. You're charming. Psychopathy, you can be that way, but you're also very impulsive. Machiavellianism is named after, you know, Machiavelli, who wrote The Prince, and it's people who are incredibly manipulative. The best example that's out there is, I think, Kevin Spacey's character in the show House of Cards.
House of Cards, yeah.
Yeah, well, he's incredibly Machiavellian in that he's willing to manipulate and use everybody. He also seems to be a little bit psychopathic, throwing people in front of trains to give away season one, sorry, to your viewers. but that's a very Machiavellian character. And then there's this sadistic group, which are people who actually take joy out of hurting people, where they get pleasure from causing other pain, which is not as common, but you see it in some cases. There's some recent research showing that internet trolls, for example, have some very sadistic qualities. But all these things they're almost like cousins. They go together. They blend a little bit with each other, but they're also different.
Is narcissism on the increase?
It is. It's we've done it. Looked at this a few ways. One, we've looked at college kids, not because, you know, not to pick on them, but they've taken personality questionnaires for a long time in psychology research, and we see narcissism scores have gone up since the early 1980s when we started measuring them. So kids today, young people today are about two-thirds of young people are higher than the average young person in 1980. So it's an increase. It's not enormous. It's an increase. The other studies, there's one big National Institute of Health study where they looked at the symptoms of clinical narcissism or narcissistic personality disorder, and they found that for young people...
You must be hearing the music.
I'm hearing the music.
All right, that's okay. We'll come right back in a moment. I wanted you to finish, but we'll come right back. And Skype will be up and running big time when we get into our new studio soon. So I'm looking forward to that when I get back to Los Angeles. And welcome back to Coast with Keith Campbell, Dr. Keith Campbell, talking about the narcissism epidemic. And Keith, you were talking about the personality disorder that's related to this. Is that what they call NPD?
Exactly. That's the shorthand for it, narcissistic personality disorder.
Would you say that Vladimir Putin is one of them?
You know, he comes across, I mean, I've obviously never interviewed him, but in terms of coming across as your classic narcissistic leader, he's perfect.
Takes his shirt off, does this.
Yeah, the shirt off on the horse. And my favorite is the picture of him holding a fishing rod the wrong way. I mean, he's holding it.
With his boots on.
So he has to flex his muscles more than if he held it at the balance point of the rod. But he's, you know, he's a loved and admired leader. It's working for him.
It is working for him. Absolutely.
For him. But, I mean, he's pulling it off.
There are many who could not pull it off, right?
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things. If you have the narcissism and you have the skills to pull it off, it can work very well. If you don't have the skills to pull it off, your life can be in trouble, or you end up moving online or something in some way to get those needs met. But for somebody like that in leadership, it seems to work.
Isn't there a big difference, though, between someone who is narcissistic or just someone who's showing incredible confidence in what they do?
Yeah, I think, first of all, with narcissism, you see overconfidence rather than just confidence. So you can have somebody who's really confident in what they do, but when that person fails, they go, man, I'm going to try to retool. I'm going to learn from this mistake. I'm going to get even better. With narcissism, people fail. They don't take responsibility for it. They just think, well, I'm going to do better next time. And so there's not that learning process that happens. So there is a relationship. Narcissists are confident, but it's not exactly the same.
If you're narcissistic, are you a bad person?
No, it's like most traits. Narcissism is really a trade-off. It's good for some things. It's bad for others. Generally, people who are narcissistic, they can be good leaders, they can be good partners, as long as your interests and their interests are aligned. So if I'm in the Soviet Union and my interests are aligned with Putin's, fantastic. The problem comes when the narcissist's interests are not aligned with yours, and that's when they can be what you think of as bad. They can exploit people, abuse people. Use people and hurt people.
I mean, how would this work in relationships, Keith, in that would a woman find a narcissistic guy attractive or not?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. People who are narcissistic, and this can be men or women, you know, we often think of it as women finding being attracted to narcissistic men, but it does work both ways. Often when they get in these relationships, it's really exciting at first. And, you know, you go, man, I met this guy. He's confident. He's great. And the relationship starts out being really exciting. You know, you give it a few months, and all of a sudden, in the point where the relationship where, you know, you start talking about, you know, empathy, your feelings, or caring, instead of that, what happens is the person you're dating is maybe being game playing, he's manipulating you, he acts
controlling, all that.
Yeah, exactly, controlling, you know, he's hitting on your friends, and then you start going, what am I doing wrong? And eventually it falls apart. Often I use this sort of metaphor of food. It's like dating a narcissist is like eating chocolate cake. You feel great for 20 minutes, and it's the best thing you ever had. And then you feel sick and you hate yourself and you're, you know, going, God, why do I always do this, eat this stupid chocolate cake? Whereas if you eat something healthy, it doesn't, you don't get that rush at the beginning, but 20 minutes later, you feel pretty good about yourself.
Sure. How many people do you think at some point in their life have been narcissistic?
You know, I think it's hard to say where you cross the line into saying, well, that's narcissistic and that's not, because it's really a continuum. But I think a lot of us at different points in our life can become more narcissistic, often in our teenage years. You know, I remember being 18, and I that was the only time in my life I knew everything. It's been downhill ever since. So there's certain times we can get more narcissistic, and then it will go away.
This is an amazing trait. It really is. Now, how would you categorize it, Keith? What would you call it? A personality disorder, which has got that disease to it. But so
yeah.
How could it have? How could you? On one hand, it be a personality disorder, and then on the other hand, it's just being narcissistic.
Yeah, that's what's really interesting about the disorders in general, and. You know, usually how we think about it is you have a trait, and it takes over to your life to the point that you can't change it. It's sort of what we call pervasive. It affects all aspects of your life, and you're inflexible. So you can't drop the narcissism even when you need to. So you go to a job interview. The time you really want to show a little humility, and you're like, I'm the best person you'll ever hire, and I'm going to be running this company in 6 months. And it starts to mess you up. When it gets that bad, it can be a disorder. So it's really that inability to adapt. On the other hand, for all of us these days, we need to have a little bit of narcissism. I mean, you need to have narcissism to promote yourself, to show enough confidence to get a job or get
a date.
So it's got to be, you know, I would say it's got to be a tool in your toolbox. It's not the 1950s anymore. You know?
Maybe the word, Keith, narcissism, is wrong for some people. I mean, to me, nothing wrong with being confident and aggressive and, you know, knowing what you want to do, as long as you don't walk into a room and say, hey, hi, I'm this and that. I mean, I got to tell you, wherever I go in... non-public speaking events, because obviously they know who I am when I walk in the door. But if I'm at a restaurant or something, I never tell people who I am or what I do if they don't know me. And, you know, I even talk to some of my friends and, you know, I chastise them a little bit after that by simply telling them, hey, you know what? Don't tell them who I am. Don't tell them what I do. And I've got one guy, he's a dear friend of mine. The first thing out of his mouth is, hey, do you know, and, you know, this talk show host, and I, you know, I almost want to punch him in the head.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's exactly what it is. I mean, if you have the ability to turn on the confidence, turn on the narcissism, but then you don't, it's not a need. I mean, what you're describing is, hey, I don't need this all the time. This isn't the core to who I am. You hear stories about other people. I mean, they told stories about Clinton when he dropped out of office, where he'd go into Harlem or whatever and sit in front of windows just to draw people to him. That there's, you know, you get this need for attention, and it can you know, like any addiction, it can take over your life.
Let's go through some past presidents. I'll mention their name. You tell me if you think they're narcissistic. Okay. Here we go.
Okay.
Let's start with John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, he's up there a little bit.
A little bit?
Yeah, maybe a little more. Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
So there's him.
Not the worst, but he's up there. Yeah.
Lyndon Johnson.
In the research, he's number one. Like, I mean, when we've looked at historians' personality ratings, he comes out as number one.
Wow.
Narcissism. Yeah.
That's something. Yeah. Richard Nixon.
Yeah, he's up there too. And he's an interesting case where he's, you know, he doesn't have the charm. You know, he's not, the charming sort of, it's Tony Stark or, you know, the Iron Man kind of narcissism. He's
right.
Much more paranoid, more vulnerable, but also narcissistic.
Jimmy Carter. I would say not, but what do you say?
he seems to be the example of the sort of the lower end of narcissism. I mean, there's no president now who's a, I mean, to be a modern president, like narcissism, sort of a job requirement in a way.
I think so too.
Yeah, but he'd definitely be on the lower end.
Jerry Ford, I'd put him on the lower end too.
Oh yeah, for sure. And you never heard about him after office. He's not out there seeking attention. I think he just went to bail.
What about Ronald Reagan?
You know, he's an interesting case because he's a case where you have a lot of that charisma. I mean, he's an actor. He's driven. I always got this, and maybe I'm a sucker, you know, and I'm a sucker for a lot of these narcissistic leaders. I get the sense he was sort of following a bigger vision a little bit. It wasn't all about, you know, President Reagan. He was sort of attached to a vision, but certainly he had a lot of sort of the narcissistic attributes.
Yeah, he did. But like, you know, like you, I would think Reagan was one who had a lot of confidence, self-confidence about him. And, you know, just knew where he was going, felt very comfortable in a public forum.
Yeah.
And he did his thing there. What about George Bush Sr.?
No, Sr. doesn't strike me that way very much at all. I mean, he was an honest to God, or he is, I mean, an honest to God hero. I mean, but you never heard about that. They talked about him they never talked about his, you know, World War II heroism, the way he was a quiet president. He doesn't strike me that way really at all.
Bill Clinton, I think you just tell us.
I think he's on the higher end. Again, this is a guy who, you know, he seems to be a policy guy. I don't think he's out there trying to hurt the world, but he does seem to like talking about Bill Clinton.
George W. Bush.
Yeah, pretty cocky guy too, but also out there, you know, spending his post-presidency trying to help kids in Africa and keeping his head down a little bit.
Barack Obama.
So, yeah, it's a tough one. I've got friends send me internet things every week about him being diagnosed. Yeah, he clearly got some ego. He also, though, doesn't have the real, he doesn't have the level of charisma that you'd see if I would say, God, the classic narcissistic president. So I'd say definitely some, but I wouldn't say he's the highest.
Now, to be successful, whether it's politics or business or sports, do you have to be narcissistic?
You don't have to be. What it is often you'll see a couple sort of outcomes of this. So with presidents, what we find is that the narcissistic presidents, the people, you know, like the Lyndon Johnsons or Roosevelts or whatever, who they can be very successful, but they also have the ethical problems, and these things tend to go hand in hand. So narcissism predicts sort of presidential greatness, but also your chance of being impeached.
I would say J. Edgar Hoover was one.
Yeah, it's a real mixed bag. When you look at CEOs, or when they've done research on corporate leaders, what you see with narcissism are people who take big risks. Sometimes they work, and that these people are seen as heroes. They make the big call and it works. Other times it collapses. They blame everybody else and they move on and do it again. So when you have enough people who are that arrogant taking risks, some will succeed and be great. Others will collapse. We don't hear about them. So I don't think it's necessary, but people who are narcissistic will take those risks, but sometimes they will pay off.
Keith, when you're out at a party, I would suspect people run away from you because they don't want you to analyze them.
No, I don't do it. I do have, I well. Stuff comes up occasionally. I'll say that.
I mean, I'd see you in a party and go, I'm not going to go meet him. Let's go the other way. No.
It's usually somebody's wife, you know, who says, well, you should meet my husband.
That's funny.
That's usually how it goes.
Can children be, have this kind of situation?
You know, with any of these traits, I don't like I just don't think you should label kids. I mean, I have a six-year-old, and she, you know, she might dance around with listening to pop music, and then she gets angry, and then she's nice, and then she attacks me. I mean, if she were an adult doing what
she's
she
a
did,
kid.
She would be diagnosed as a sort of a narcissistic borderline psychopath. I mean, but she's six.
But so do they carry that into their adult life, or do they grow out of it?
Well, most kids do. I mean, most kids, you know, they grow out of their narcissism and their impulsivity and all these very negative traits when they become adults. If they don't, it can lead to a lot of problems. That said, you can predict narcissism a little bit from kids' behavior. Sometimes you see reports of kids who, you know, or don't follow the rules enough, and they end up being a little more narcissistic when they grow up. So there's some continuity in personality, but it's not so direct that I would ever want to label a child a narcissist or because I'd label them all that way.
Years ago, when I was working at a public relations firm in St. Louis, we had a guy who would come in at 7 o'clock in the morning. The president of the company always came in early, came in at 7 in the morning. And this guy would come in at 7 in the morning because he wanted to garner the attention of the president. And we had a office structure, Keith, that was a huge square. And the hallway went around the square. So, and all the offices were attached to the outside. So you get this picture, you can walk a square and you walk around this huge office building.
Mm-hmm.
And the president's down at one corner. This guy was way down on the other side of the building. But what he would do is at 7 o'clock in the morning, he would walk around that entire square as he walked past the president's office. And if the president didn't look up, he'd keep walking and come back again and again. And again, until the president of the company finally noticed and looked up. Well, one day, and this was hilarious, he must have walked three or four times. The president was doing his thing, had his head down. And the fourth time, the story goes, the president of our company looked up and said, "I saw you the first time, Mark." And, I mean, now, would a person like that be narcissistic by the fact that he wants that kind of attention?
It's interesting because, you know, that's a classic strategy, you know, we talk about, which is ingratiation or sucking up. And it's a very good strategy for getting ahead in life. Usually your coworkers notice it, but people in power,
they don't.
It works. Except in this case, obviously, it did.
He did. Yeah, he spotted it.
So I wouldn't say this person was necessarily narcissistic, but I need to know more information. So is his dream to get the office right next to the president? Would he, if he were friends with, you know, if you were next to the president, would he drop the president's name all the time?
Yeah, exactly.
Would he give himself a phony title? Would he do things like that that would suggest more narcissism?
Now, that's an interesting thing you bring up, too, that people who are out at an event or at a party and they drop names of people, you know, well-known, prominent people, they're doing that to make themselves seem important. Is that
right.
A trait? Is that a trait of this? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a way of saying I associate with powerful, important people, and I know what's going on, therefore I'm powerful and important.
Interesting take.
It can work sometimes, and other times people think you're kind of an arrogant jerk.
All right, Keith, when we come back, we're going to take some phone calls with you. And if you want to share your stories about narcissism, check in with us on Coast to Coast AM. Need to email me. It's george@coasttocoastam.com. All of you download our apps, by the way. And if you're a Coast Insider, that app will do all kinds of things for you. But you can pick them in the iPhone and the Android stores or in our store at coasttocoastam.com.